I probably should not start out by saying this, but I had this discussion with my rabbinical students at the UJ just last week. So I'm going to be I'm going to say the same thing to you I did to them. They were not happy with this, but I must say this is the brit. This is the covenant between God and the Jewish people, and I wish it were. I wish it were more moving. There's something very obscure and difficult and not entirely as elegant and beautiful about this passage as I wish there were. Because we read the first part, and I want to now look at the covenant itself, and you will see, because I anthologized just a couple of the commentators and what they say about the Brit Ben Habtarim, that it's very hard to figure out exactly what's going on. And you would hope for something that was clearer, but nonetheless, we will work with what we have and try to make some progress and understand it. And then next week, we return to the story of the families, which is with Hagar and Ishmael, and that is, I think, even though it may not be as dramatic as a fire coming from heaven, it is in some ways much more interesting. And on that note, those of you who don't receive it, each week we send out an email where I write a 200-word column. It appears in the Jewish Week, and we also send it out by email. And that also, with that email, we also send out that week's sermon topic. If you want to be on that list, just email Rebecca at rbagan@sinaitemple.org, or call her, give her your email address, and each week we'll send you. It's called Off the Pulpit. And you'll get it today or tomorrow if you call her, and this week's sermon topic is going to be about divorce. So those of you who are interested, and also don't forget we have Deborah Lipstadt this weekend as our scholar in residence. So I hope that you will be able to come. Her email is rbegin, B-E-G-I-N, just like Menachem, rbegin@sinaitemple.org. All of the Sinai Temple employees are the first initial, last name, @sinaitemple.org. All the Sinai Akiba employees are first initial, last name, @sinaiakiba.org. Okay? Anyway, R. Begin, and she will be happy to put you on the list and to send you. And if you ask her for some old ones, she'll probably send you those too, because we've been sending them out for years. Okay. I'm going to start with chapter 15, verse 7. Actually, you know what? I'll read the whole chapter just to get, because it'll only take a second, just to bring us up to date. And for those of you who weren't here last time, chapter 15. Sometime later, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision, and he said, "Fear not, Abraham, I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." But Abraham said, "O Lord God, what can you give me, seeing that I will die childless, and the one in charge of my household is Damesek Eliezer?" In other words, he's going to inherit instead of my kids. Abram said further, remember, he's not yet Avraham, he's still Avram, "Since you've granted me no offspring, my steward will be my heir." The word of the Lord came to him in reply, "That one shall not be your heir. None but your very own issue shall be your heir." He took him outside and said, "Look toward the heaven and count the stars, if you are able to count them." And he added, "So shall your offspring be. Ko yiye zarecha." And because he put his trust in the Lord, he reckoned it to his merit. That's as far as we went last time, but since we read it again, Ko yiye zarecha, so will your offspring be. That's his blessing to Abraham, which gives rise to one of the most lovely midrashim that is very useful for rabbis at brises and baby namings. And that is about the man who comes to a, it says, why does God bless Abraham by saying, so will your offspring be? And the answer that is given in Bereishit Rabbah and the midrash on this is a story of a man who comes, is wandering in a desert, is very thirsty, comes by an oasis. He sits in the shade of the tree. He drinks the water that's at the roots of the tree by a little stream. He eats its fruit. And then as he's ready to leave, he looks at the tree and he says, you know, I want to bless you, but I don't know how to bless you. I could bless you by wishing that you had beautiful leaves and shade, but you already do. And I could wish you by praying that your fruit be sweet, but it already is, or that you had water, but there's water at your roots. So the only way I can bless you is, Ko yezarecha, may all who come from you be like you. And that's God's blessing of Abraham. Abraham has everything. So the only way God can bless Abraham is by saying, may everyone who comes from you be like you. So it's a beautiful blessing and a beautiful midrash. And then God moves on to the brit. Brit bein ha-betarim, the brit, the covenant between the pieces. That's the way it's known. Pieces because, as you will see, the animals are divided. Okay? Then he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to assign this land to you as a possession. And he said, O Lord God, how shall I know that I am to possess it? He answered, bring me a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old she-goat, a three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young bird. Not the answer that you expect from God when you say, you know, how do I know that I'm going to inherit this promised land? He says, well, bring me some animals, some livestock, and then we'll talk. But remember, you have to put yourself in the mentality of the ancient world, and this is a covenant. And a covenant involves some kind of symbolic sacrifice, some kind of gesture, which reminds you of what? What kind of covenant involves something that's similar to this? A brit milah. A brit milah also involves cutting, blood, sacrifice. Right? That's a covenant. In fact, for those of you who I'm currently reading and about to review a book by a social anthropologist about the history of covenant and brit and the medical implications of a bris and so on and so forth, he is not in favor of it, and I'm going to be reviewing it for BeliefNet, but I'm also going to be doing my next Lunch and Learn about the issue of brit milah. So for those of you who are interested, the book is called Marking Your Flesh, or Marking the Flesh. It's by Leonard Glick. It is not a zippy read. He goes through the history and the church fathers and the rabbis and social anthropology, but it's important. And I'll be summarizing what he says and reaction, as I said, in the next Lunch and Learn, which is it's the first Tuesday of the month, which is December 6th. Okay. He brought him all these and cut them in two, placing each half opposite the other, but he did not cut up the bird. So the first thing is, for some reason or other that you have to explain, he doesn't cut the bird. Okay? When he sacrifices all these, the bird is the one animal that's not cleaved in two. Birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away, like vultures. Right. As the sun was about to set, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and a great dark dread descended upon him. He said to Abram, know well that your offspring shall be strangers in a land not theirs, and they shall be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will execute judgment on the nation they shall serve, and in the end, they shall go free with great wealth. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a ripe old age. And they shall return here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So now let's follow again what has happened up to this point. God tells Abram to bring these animals. Abram brings them. He puts them on the altar. He splits them in half, except for the bird. Birds come from the sky to eat the carcasses. Abraham chases them away and then falls into this deep visionary sleep. God comes and predicts the slavery in Egypt. God says, you will have this, not you, but your descendants will be enslaved in Egypt, and they will eventually be freed. The only reason that God gives is what? That the Amorites who currently live in Canaan haven't sinned enough yet for me to kick them out. That's what it means, the iniquity is not yet full. Right? It's like when you say to a child, one more time and I'll take that toy away. Not yet, but next time. And that's what God's saying about the Amorites, that they will be dispossessed, but they will not be dispossessed yet. And we will talk about this, in what sense do they have free will if God knows they're going to do this? And what kind of God is it that tells you that your descendants are going to be enslaved, as though they have no choice? But he says to Abraham, you're going to be okay. You'll live a decent life. You'll die in ripe old age, which is exactly what happens. And then eventually the people will inherit the land as is promised. Okay? Are we clear so far on... Yes?
Actually, Rabbi, I want to know, why does it tell him that your nation will be punished, and what happened here? What did they do that they would be punished?
It doesn't say. All we know, I mean, there are two separate questions here. One is, why does God do it? And the other is, what does Abraham understand from it? All Abraham knows is that God is telling him the future. That's all. God's letting him know what's going to happen. Your children will be enslaved, and they will be free. Now, why does God tell him? I mean, maybe that's the kind of relationship he has with Abraham. He tells him the good stuff and the bad stuff. He doesn't want to deceive him. He doesn't want to pretend it's all going to be fine. Maybe because he needs Abram to know before he has a child that his children are going to suffer. He doesn't want him to have a child under false pretenses. Why God decides that the children of Israel must suffer comes later. That comes later. Why do they have to be slaves in Egypt? Well, the traditional answers are because of the sins that Joseph's brothers commit, right? Because of the sins that, for that matter, not just Joseph's brothers, but all the forefathers commit various sins, including Abram. Remember, we saw earlier that some people attribute the slavery to Abram's having questioned God. Right. And it also could be that it could be the back at the other end. That is, here's the slavery in Egypt. Maybe it's because of a sin that happened before, or maybe it's because of what the Israelites need to do in order to make liberation happen later. Maybe they have to go through that experience to become the people that God wants them to be. Whereas if they had just had a smooth time in the world, they wouldn't have been able to become such a people. I don't know. There are lots of speculations, as you can imagine, but God never gives an unambiguous single reason why the Israelites had to be enslaved. Yeah. Yes, there is. Okay, I'll say more than that. This is one of the like two or three greatest long-standing religious problems. If God knows what you're going to do, do you have free will to do it? Rabbi Akiva, in fact, addressed this directly, and he said, in what has become a famous rabbinic phrase, "Hakol tzafui v'harashut nituna," which translates to, "Everything is foreseen, but free will is granted." Which is just a way of saying, you know, you figure it out. So part of me feels like, okay, if Rabbi Akiva couldn't figure it out, you know. But I will give you one nice theory that arose in the Middle Ages and is associated with Ralbag, Gersonides, who was a philosopher. And it goes something like this. He adds all sorts of twists and stuff. But what he says is, God knows everything that can be known. God, for example, does not know what it's like to live with a unicorn because there's no such thing as a unicorn. God doesn't know there's a famous nonsense sentence that's used in linguistic study to prove that which makes sense in grammar doesn't always make sense in meaning. It's something like, I think it's long green ideas sleep furiously. It's grammatically correct, but it doesn't mean anything. So Gersonides would say, God can't know what long green ideas sleep furiously means because there's nothing to know. It doesn't exist. The meaning of that sentence doesn't exist. It's meaningless. So Gersonides says the future is that which is not. The future hasn't been. So God can't know the future because there's nothing to know. It doesn't exist. God only knows probabilities based on the past. But God can't know the future because there is no future yet until it happens. So for Gersonides, God doesn't know the future. What God has is a comprehensive knowledge of all the circumstances of the past. So God can predict with great accuracy, you know, who's going to win the trifecta. But he doesn't know for sure. The same thing, but here, it does seem like in the Bible, God knows for sure certain things are going to happen. So, yeah.
How does God talk to Abraham?
Doesn't say. I mean, the answer is it doesn't say. There are lots of speculations about how God speaks. And there is discussion of how God speaks to Moshe, right? Panim el panim, or pe le pe, mouth to mouth, face to face. Here it seems some kind of visionary dream, but it doesn't say for sure, which is why, by the way, well, when we come to the Akedah, which we'll spend a lot of time on, the binding of Isaac, that was Kant's great objection to the Akedah, Immanuel Kant. He said, Abraham didn't know. How could he know God was saying this to him? Maybe it wasn't, maybe it was a delusion. Yeah. Yes, it does. It doesn't. He would say it doesn't argue for God's limitations because it's not limiting to say you know something that can't be known.
Well, the second thing is that isn't that the definition of a prophet? Somebody who understands the past and deeply understands
yes.
the present, and therefore has done.
Yes, it is. It's very much like the prophet who understands the present and therefore can project into the future. But God has, you know, much more, infinitely more prophetic power. So, at least according to Gersonides, most people don't accept that. But
so,
yeah.
So
hold one sec. Yeah. Hold on one second. Yes.
Doesn't it also speak to the idea, the conservative idea that the Torah was written afterwards?
Yes, I mentioned that last time. Right. The most logical explanation. Do you remember, I don't know if any of you remember The Amazing Kreskin. The Amazing Kreskin, well, you do, obviously. The Amazing Kreskin used to do a great bit where he would write down, where he would have this box that had been sealed and it had been like under lock and key and the government had been guarding it and so on. And he had given it to them a week before and he would open it up and inside would be the headline from that day's newspaper. Okay? Now, there are two explanations of this. Either God gave the Amazing Kreskin, who admitted he was a magician, right? He said, I'm a magician. That's what I am. Either God gave him prophetic powers or somehow he wrote down that day and got it into the box. We don't know how. We automatically assume, however remarkable he is, that because he doesn't kid about, you know, being a magician, that somehow he got it in that box. Critical scholars of the Bible assume that the same trick is happening here. That is, this was written after the slavery and put in God's mouth retroactively, whatever the right word is, and so God speaks it. Obviously, that is not the classical Jewish view. So both are possible views of the Torah. But even if you believe that this was written afterwards, even if you believe that, the question still remains, does God know the future? Yeah.
About this projection, so potentially Abraham had the opportunity to change that future, because here is God saying,
but when you say,
to the past, this is the projection of future.
But that's not what God says. That's only what Gersonides might say. But in the Bible, God says this will happen. So it doesn't seem that's the problem with the free will. It doesn't seem like Avram has any choice in the matter. God doesn't say to him, if your descendants continue to act, you know, that's, remember what Jonah says at Nineveh. Jonah says, if you continue to do this, you're going to get it in the neck. They change their behavior, they change their fate, but that's not, that doesn't seem to be here. So, yes. They were really enslaved for 200. The math is complicated. Rashi has a long thing that is much discussed, and when we get to the slavery, we'll talk about it. They're really in Egypt for only over 200 years, but the entire process from beginning to end takes 400. So you're right. Yeah. the entire process.
Now another thing, just I think maybe Akiva, maybe it's a little bit more Kabbalistic view, that there are different layers of different destinies.
Right.
And I don't know, you said it, but many, many different destinies, but you can change it on the path that you're taking your life.
Yeah, well, that's actually the idea that you have different destinies, different possible destinies, is, I think, although it is a Kabbalistic view, it's also a mainstream Jewish view, that you really do have different paths and you can change it. That's what makes this so problematic. Because look, Yom Kippur is all about, I sinned before, but I'm not going to sin again. And you it presumes that you have free will and that you can do what you want. So It's a problem, and we will deal with it more. It'll come up again and again. Let's take two more and then go on. Go ahead.
Could it be that if God, as a parent, is saying, "I know what my children will be like"?
Yes, but parents can be wrong. Right, they can be. That's the problem.
I know my children. This is how it's going
to. Right. Yeah, but even then, it's true. It is similar, but the problem here is that God has no room to be wrong, and therefore it seems that people have no room to change or to be different. Yeah.
Wouldn't it be like just saying human nature is such that this is going to happen? You didn't say when. You didn't say.
But it gives too many particulars. To say human nature is such that there will be slavery in the world is one thing. To say the Jews will be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years is very comprehensive knowledge of human behavior that seems to leave no real room for something else to happen. I mean, what if the Egyptians had repented, like the Ninevites repented, or I don't know.
We have Yom Kippur every year.
We do, but that's because that's based on the knowledge that human beings will sin,
right. But
not based on specific, you'll do this in this situation, right? In specifics, we have, there's a really nice passage, actually, I have it somewhere, in the way of all flesh, which is a classic 19th century novel by Samuel Butler. He says that growing up, he thought, growing up in the church with the confessional, he thought that there would clearly be a time when he would grow up and he would get older and his soul wouldn't need confessional as often. It wouldn't need as much rubbing and scrubbing, he says, the way he puts it, as he did when he was a kid. He says, but now I'm an adult and I realize that the church has estimated probabilities better than I did. I always like that. So, yeah, it's clear that God knows that people will sin, but that he says that they'll be enslaved and oppressed 400 years and then I'll execute judgment on them and then they'll go free. That's already a high level of detail. Okay, let's finish the...
In a way, that's relieving, I think, for me to say that God is giving room for sin. So don't be surprised if your children's sin is part of
it. Oh, well, don't forget, there is a confessional in every morning service. It's not only on Yom Kippur. There's a confessional in every morning service. Now, we skip it sometimes at special moments during the year, during holidays, other times. But if you go to a regular morning service, there's something called tachanun, where you put your hand down on your arm and you say a couple of psalms that are confessional psalms. And that's because the tradition assumes that people sin every day. Because we do.
Yeah. Why does God tolerate that Abraham argues for the father Gabriel sinning?
Okay. It's a great question. Let's save it for when we get to Sodom and Gomorrah, just because why does God tolerate Abraham's arguing for Sodom and Gomorrah? But let's go on, because I want to do 15 today, and I have to speak to prospective parents soon, so I can't stay late. Actually, I have to leave a couple minutes early. All right. When the sun set and it was very dark, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between those pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your offspring I assign this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites." Okay. Now, we finished the chapter. Now we can talk. Several things. First of all, those are all the people that lived in ancient Jerusalem. Yehuda Amichai has a beautiful poem about Jerusalem that begins that the city whispers Yevus, Yevus, Yevus. Yevus was the name of the Jebusites. In other words, before, we forget that Jerusalem had this long history before any Jews got there. it's really, it's a remarkable place. For some reason, it has always been a center. This border of the land is much, much larger than any Israelite border has ever been or is ever likely to be. This is what the rabbis call the messianic border. I mean, it covers, you know, everything. If we had this much land, things would be different, or maybe not. So, but the central question of the chapter that we have not dealt with is, what's the business about the flaming torch passing between the pieces? And why those animals? Why isn't the bird divided and all of that? So for that, I have brought three commentators, the Rambam, Malbim, and Radak. Rambam is a 12th century, 11th, 12th century Spanish commentator. Rough contemporary of Maimonides, a little bit after. Malbim is much later, from Eastern Europe, I think 1800s. And Radak is also an early medieval commentator, Rav David Kimchi. So, by the way, if you have an Eitz Chaim, in the very back of the Eitz Chaim, you'll see that it has a little biographical sentence or two on all the commentators who are quoted in that book. So if you ever want to look up who someone is, you can look back there. Okay? All right. Let's start with Ramban, Nachmanides. The three-year-old heifer alludes to three kinds of sacrifices Israel would offer to God: the burnt offering, the sin offering, the peace offering. The dividing of the carcasses, that is, the corpses, implied that he made a covenant to pass through the pieces, and all the sacrifices of the birds and beasts would be from these kinds. In other words, these are the kinds of things you bring for sacrifice. This is the paradigm. From now on, this is what sacrifice is, and these are the kinds of animals you use. And sacrifices were always cut in pieces. The bird was not divided, since regarding the fowl that is offered up, it is stated, he may not divide. Now let me explain. Ramban, this is the first way of looking at it. He's looking at this as presaging, that is, letting us know what the laws of sacrifice are going to be. Since the way you sacrifice in Leviticus is you don't divide the bird, Abraham doesn't divide the bird. Since you sacrifice cows, Abraham sacrifices cows. In other words, God is letting Abraham know, and through Abraham letting us know, because remember, the Torah, God's always speaking to be overheard, right? Never just to Abraham, also to us, which is a nice Chaim Jannat, who was once a very popular, just around the time of the Amazing Kreskin, was a very popular child psychologist and teacher, said, if you want your kids to be good, let them overhear you saying good things about them. In other words, instead of saying to your child, you're good, let your kid hear you say it to another parent. That's why at a bar and bat mitzvah meeting, I always ask the parents about their child, so they have a chance to tell me, in the child's hearing, what their child is like. And most parents take advantage of this. They may make a critical comment or two, but which is fine. That's perfectly all right. They can say, you know, I wish that he were more disciplined, but he is this and he's that and he's the other thing. And I always, you know, you can see the child hearing the parent express for the first time what they're like, because we don't do that normally. Okay, the swooping down of birds of prey and Abraham's driving them away symbolize that the heathens would try to abrogate the sacrifices, but the seed of Abraham would drive them away. And lo, a dread and great darkness fell upon him. That alludes, and this is a common interpretation of this, to the subjugation of the four kingdoms. Four terms are used consecutively. Dread, darkness, which becomes greater, which he felt as if it was falling upon him like a burden, too heavy to bear. The dread is Babylon. The darkness is Medea. Medea is, anyone? What's Medea? Persia. Which darkened Israel with fast and affliction. Great is the kingdom of Antiochus, Syria, or the Seleucid kingdom. Fell upon him is Edom, Rome. And the rabbis consider we are still living under the subjugation of Rome. The fourth kingdom continues, okay? Edom. Because after all, we haven't come to the Messianic kingdom, and if there are only four and Rome started it, we got to still be with Rome. We got nowhere else to go. God was telling Abraham in this way that while he was making a covenant to bequeath the land to his descendants for an eternal possession, nevertheless, there was one reservation in his gift. If his children sinned, they'd be subjected to these four exiles. Afterward, he informed them about another exile, their first one, that of Egypt. Okay, that's Ramban's interpretation of what this is. Malbim. Well, let's go to Malbim. We don't have to do it chronologically. The various beasts symbolize man's physical powers, all of which have to be brought under control of the soul. Abraham divided the beast. He already brought his physical instincts under the control of his soul, dedicated them to the service of God, but the bird, his soul had not been divided, had not died within him, but was still living, governing his flesh. In other words, he subdued it, but it was not gone. The bird of prey, his divine soul, descended on the carcasses to revive them with its spiritual vitality. Vayeshev otam Avraham. Not Avraham drove them away, but blew into the carcasses a breath of life. He revived them through the bird of prey. The bird of prey, Ait, represents Abraham's inner spiritual essence, his complete devotion to God, by which he killed all his animal instincts and revitalized his soul. Okay? That's the Malbim. Radax is a long one. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But you can read it. He talks about it also symbolically, but mostly historically. He does the same thing that Ramban does, which is why I was going to read it first chronologically. That is, he sees this as a historical paradigm. This is what's going to happen to the Jewish people. This is why it's going to happen to the Jewish people. Look at the top. The heifer symbolizes the first exile in Egypt. And look at the second paragraph, and you'll get a sense of his method. A turtle dove and a young pigeon. They are preyed upon, but do not prey. The female will not accept another male after the death of her mate. So it is with Israel. In exile, she's like a widow in exile. The day her husband parted from her with him is very much alive. She serves no other gods, and obviously he brings a verse to prove it, and the idea that she's preyed upon but doesn't prey is his paradigm for Israel. Israel is persecuted but does not persecute. And look at the last paragraph just to give you a little bit of more of a flavor. The birds of prey came down on the carcasses, referring to the whole ones, the turtle dove and the pigeon. He drove them away, symbolizing that in every generation the nations attempt to exterminate us, but the Holy One, blessed be He, delivers us from His hands by the merit of Abraham. As it is said, yet for all that they, when they are in the land of my enemies, I won't reject them or destroy them utterly to break my covenant with them, as well as, but I will remember for the sakes of the covenant of their ancestors. Very much like the Pesach Haggadah. Yes?
This feels a lot to me like the idea that you often talk about of the last remaining Western, and what is the man who rises on white?
Right. Yes.
Because I feel like we are missing something enormous here, and there's really no way for us to know why those
right.
Why they were divided, why any of this really happened, and it was probably in some kind of context of that age that is completely lost to us.
The only thing, I think that you're right, that there clearly are nuances here that we don't know. I mean, we're so far even from sacrifices, much less. The only thing that we can do is look at, which is why Ramban does this, the subsequent history of sacrifices, because there are so many in the Bible and so extensive, and try to figure out how this fits into them. But if it's an earlier example, then a lot of it, yeah, is lost. So, so now, let's summarize where we are. And once again, now that everybody's here, I want to mention again what I said before, if you are interested. I send out a weekly message. If you want to be on that email weekly message, it also gives you the sermon topic for the week. Then call my office or email my secretary, Rebecca Bagan, rbagan@sinaitemple.org, and she will sign you up for that. This week, the topic is the question of divorce. And by the way, it's still the story of Abraham. So, sort of Abraham and divorce. It's about the title of the sermon is Sacrificing Our Children or Sacrificing Ourselves. And also Deborah Lipstadt is this weekend. Please don't forget. Remarkable person and a wonderful scholar. So, where are we? We are now, Abraham, let's recap the story of Abraham, because now Abraham and God have a covenant. And somehow this covenant must add something to the initial covenant. Because remember, God and Abraham are already tight, you know? God has already come to Abraham and said, I'm going to make you a great nation at the very beginning of chapter 12, and everybody will be blessed through you, and so on and so forth. And although at the beginning of this chapter, Abraham's upset because he doesn't have children, which is what this all is going to be about. Remember, in the next chapter, we're about to do the Hagar-Yishmael story. Even though Abraham doesn't have children, what he has in his pocket is God's promise of children. That he's already got. So presumably, somehow, this is going to work. God comes to Abraham in this chapter and says, how do you know that you're going to be taken care of? Get me some animals. Now, one thing that we haven't said is the way that God effectuates, makes happen this sacrifice, is a fire moves through the pieces of the animals, which means that Abraham is witness to something miraculous. Right? It does. I mean, Abraham didn't light the fire, and this is the first time that that's happened, and the demonstration of something miraculous may be part of what God is trying to demonstrate here. That is, the world is in my control. I can do remarkable things. I promise you that this will happen. And the other strange thing about it, in a way, which just occurred to me, I never really thought about it before, but maybe we can make something of this, is when someone offers a sacrifice, who offers it to whom? Right, human beings offer a sacrifice to God, but here it's not so clear. God says, get the animals. Abraham gets the animals. God sends the fire. It's almost collaborative in a way. It's not like Abraham said, I got to go sacrifice to God, and goes out and gets the animals and puts them on the altar and sets them on fire like the priests do in the temple. This is God and Abraham sacrificing together because I think the reason is because what is this? This is the covenant, right? It's got to be two-sided. It has to be both of them. After all, we owe obligations in the covenant, and so does God. We both do. And so that which marks the covenant has to be reciprocal. And here you have a reciprocal sacrifice. It's one of the reasons, by the way, when you sacrifice in the temple, most of the time, who eats what is sacrificed? The priests do. God doesn't, right? When I say most of the time, some of it gets burnt. But that means that the priest consumes and God consumes. It's reciprocal. It's covenantal. So you both get something out of it. And now, all of a sudden, Abraham is ready to build his family. Because even though he's 99, which presumably is, you know, somewhat, actually he's not quite 99 yet. He's probably around, what, I don't remember how old Ishmael is when Isaac is born. What's he, 13? So he's in his late 80s. but nonetheless, is prepared now for a family, even though he may not feel it himself. Okay, let me stop there for a minute. Questions or comments about anything that we did today or about the Abraham story thus far? Yeah.
I somehow felt that there were several places where something like a brit could be called a brit. But also later on when they talk about the brit milah.
Right.
And here, what is the pieces in Hebrew and how come we never hear of this?
It's brit ben habitarim. That's what it's called, the covenant between the pieces. Habitarim. The shoresh, the root is bet, taf, resh. Batar is still in Aramaic, to slice or to cut. And the reason you don't hear about it is what I was saying at the beginning, is there's something not as dramatic and as, I mean, Sinai, you know, but putting some animals on an altar and slicing them up to the modern sensibility, even though it's very dramatic, it doesn't have. When people speak about this parsha in synagogue, they rarely speak about the Brit Ben Habitarim. So, yeah.
In verse 13, it was a big exile.
Yes.
There's this little line between Ger and Yeh. And then when you go back to number 13, to chapter 13, in sentence 10, before he says, funny thing, this is the translation, says this was before the Lord had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, that's right. The same line. As if that when you make predictions about the future, suddenly this line appears, and I don't know whether that's true anywhere else, but it's, I just don't know why it puts a line there at all.
I don't know the answer to that. There's also one, I mean, I see it appear other places. Look at verse 16. After Asher in chapter 13. I don't know why the line appears there, but I will ask and try to find out. It's an interesting question. And certainly would make a very nice, you made a very nice drash out of it. Seriously, a very nice drash. But I don't know what the line is. Does everybody understand what Nathan is talking about? Look at verse 13. In our chapter, it says, "And he said to Abraham, know well that your offspring shall be strangers," right? In the Hebrew, look at verse 13. After the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh word, there's a straight line. Sixth word, I'm sorry. Between the sixth and the seventh word. Those two words are strangers, will be. So it's right at the crux of the prediction of the future that that line appears. And he was asking whether that has something to do with it. To which my answer was, I don't know. But it's a really good possibility. Yes, 1-2.
Yeah. When he says,
yeah.
I promise you land, you see.
Yes. Well, it's not a political question. It becomes clear, he says to him clearly in the next chapter, as you will see, that Ishmael is not the one who will inherit, that Isaac is the one who will inherit. This is exactly why the Quran rewrites the Bible. The Quran rewrites the Bible because the Bible is very explicit that it's Isaac and not Ishmael who inherits and is the Bechor, is the firstborn. Whereas, remember, in the Quran, it has Ishmael being carried up to the mountain to be sacrificed, not Isaac. And according to Islam, that's because Muhammad received the correct version. The Jews had corrupted the text between the time when they received it and the time of Muhammad's appearance. So, yeah.
I want to look at this just for a second from a psychological point of view, and Keith, you'll tell me if I'm right. During the covenant itself, the sacrifices, for me, it's a feeling that it's empowering in some way to Abraham, and it's not as though everything's being done for him. He's part of it. He's participating, which is then followed by the prophecy.
Right.
The promise. And it's almost like if you're training a child, if you're training somebody, you give them something as a reward. They do what you want, and you give them a reward. So it's like a good feeling followed by an even better feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to me like it's just a little bit of a setup on purpose that way.
But a setup in a good way.
Good way.
Right. It's an educational, it's pedagogic. That God says, this is what will happen. You do what I say. Well, there's a lot of, if you do what I say, you'll be rewarded in the Bible. It's one of the things that makes it so problematic sometimes. Because, right, because if you keep the covenant. The question, of course, about the covenant is, can you renounce it? Because in Jewish tradition, you cannot really renounce the covenant. Right? That's why you're always a Jew. Right, you can become even part of another religion, and according strictly to Jewish tradition, you're still obligated to the mitzvot. You may not like it, but you are. Now, there's a history behind that, and with that, I'm going to have to conclude today, but the history behind it in part, and this is Yaakov Katz, who has a wonderful article about this. Jacob Katz was a social historian in Israel who died a few years ago and did a lot in modern Jewish history. There is a phrase that appears again and again in medieval Jewish history, Yisrael, af al pi shechata Yisrael hu. An Israelite, even if he sins, is an Israelite. Sins here means converts. Because throughout Jewish history, there were conversions, some of which were sincere, but a lot of which were under duress, right? You have to convert, you die, you lose your job, social pressure, so on and so forth. Now, what happens if you convert to another religion and then persecution ends and you want to become a Jew? What's the Jewish community's attitude? Do you put those people through a complete conversion, thereby humiliating them and making it difficult for them to come back to Judaism? So the Jewish community established this principle, Yisrael afal pi shechata Yisrael, who an Israelite, even if they sin, is an Israelite. But the implication of that is that even if you convert sincerely, you're still an Israelite too, right? If you're going to say that an Israelite who converts is still an Israelite, then whether they come back to Judaism or not, they're still an Israelite. So according to the Jewish tradition, if you have somebody who's mother converted to Christianity and was brought up a Christian, strictly speaking, according to Jewish law, they're still obligated to all the Jewish practices. And what we tend to do is we ask them to go to mikveh and to learn, and then at the mikveh we say a special blessing. But whether you would have to convert a boy, for example, would you have to do hatafat dam brit, which is extracting a drop of blood, is a real question. Because strictly speaking, they're still Jewish, because you can't renounce the covenant. You're not allowed to leave. Yes?
What happens to the descendants of those people?
Again, it depends how they descend. If they descend through the mother, so strictly speaking, you know, this is, I mean, you know, here's where Jewish law and the reality of the situation can't fit together properly. They just can't. I mean, you get situations where people are clearly have been for generations identified with another religion or tradition, and to say that they're Jewish has no meaningful content. But what happens is, of course, if somebody in that tradition starts to come back, then it becomes that much more beautiful, like the Jew from Saragossa story. Okay, with that today, I have to finish. And what's that?
Summarize
what?
The covenant is that I will give you children and...
The covenant is that you'll inherit the land, that I will give, your offspring will be numerous, and your part of the covenant is to follow God's law. And there are other promises made along the way, but those are the ones for the moment.